The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org. Look for the Conferences tab. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Good afternoon. This is School Safety 101 and Beyond. I'm Tina Armstrong. Welcome. Small group, I know you want to be here if you're here this late this afternoon. This talk is an outgrowth of some conversations last summer after the Aurora, Colorado shootings and long before Newtown, Connecticut. I am sure that these and other incidences have been on your minds as well as boards and administrators this school year. Let's turn our minds then to the daunting task of school safety. It begins and ends with the sovereignty of God. Being anxious in nothing, we cast our cares upon Him, praying for hedges to surround our schools, and in a post 9/11 world, standing firm in our callings, seeking God's blessing. So we rest in Him. Let's pray together. Our dear Father in heaven, we commit this time to you and ask your blessing upon it for your glory. May we yield our schools and classes to your direction daily. Inspire us toward fulfilling your purposes. In Jesus' name, amen. In this hour that we have together, I want to hit the high points in respect to basic school safety, discuss preparation, talk about the dynamic nature of these plans, and then share some practical ideas with you. So hopefully you can take these back and they will help you in building a comprehensive safety program at your school. First of all, this is not an end-all in school safety, and I'm sure you realize this. It's a framework, and we hope that you can build upon it. If you're anything like me in my 17-plus years in school administration, when I'm asked what kinds of things keep me up at night, nothing or a few things are in contention, like the safety of the students entrusted to us on a daily basis. So I take this responsibility seriously, as I know you do as well. We say that we provide a safe environment for students to learn. If you've spent more than a day in school administration, you realize that this core promise takes much work and diligence. So as the ant in Proverbs 6, we're told to consider its ways and be wise. Without a commander, ruler, or overseer, it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. So these work principles apply to much of what we do in school administration. But particularly today, we want to look at school safety. There's much said in the New Testament about preparedness, and yet we prayerfully plan and the Lord directs our steps. Proverbs 19:21 states, "Many are the plans in a person's heart, but it is the Lord and His purposes that prevail." So let's start at the beginning by covering the basics first. Health, sanitation, security, inclement weather, fire, and lock-in and lockdown. This will be a bit like drinking from a fire hose. So let's begin with health. Establish a good sick leave policy. When a student is to be sent home due to fever, what constitutes a fever? If vomiting, send them home. And then determine when the student may return to school. Fever-free for 24 hours without fever-reducing medication. Be clear and be sure that your practices are practical. then hold the standard. At our school, on any given day, 450 to 500 students are going to have a recess at least once, possibly twice. So the nurse's station is a busy place, and that happens to be outside my office. So there are three things that are a staple: Band-Aids, water, and ice bags. So about 80% of our students' needs can be filled with those three things. And I do want to encourage you to monitor water intake all year. So we contact parents anytime a student hits their heads. So concussions don't always present in the same way, and we err on the side of caution. So with sports, we've seen a rise in concussions. Good hand washing is still the best defense against illness. So demonstrate how to properly wash hands, post signs in the bathrooms, and remind the students to wash their hands with every visit to the bathrooms. Cover coughs with the crease of your elbow, like this, keeping the hands germ-free. Where possible, have the students step outside the classroom to blow their noses, disposing of tissues, and yes, washing their hands, or using hand sanitizer. So the use of hand sanitizer should be a common practice. Wipe down student desk contact surfaces, including doorknobs, often. And then monitor and track illnesses in your school. So this may not be the same as absences. So at any given time, you really should know how many students are out sick and why they're out sick. And watch for clusters in the classrooms. Decide when you're going to notify a specific classroom, grade level, or school due to such things as chickenpox or Fifth's disease, and then other highly contagious illnesses such as confirmed flu, strep throat, pink eye, those kinds of things. Head lice also can be a nuisance, so have several people trained on your staff who can identify them, and then have a handout for parents and a form saying your child was evaluated and they're at this stage, and this is how you treat, this is how you retreat, and all of the things that need to be done at the home and in the car for extinguishing those pesky things. And then document everything. Know how you're going to handle over-the-counter drugs and prescription medications while at school. Where they're to be housed, away from access for younger students, and then document times, dosages, and who is administering these medications. Keep good records. Anytime fever-reducing medication is given for younger students, be sure to contact parents. Require parents to submit medical action plans describing existing illnesses or conditions requiring special care. Include instructions of the symptoms and how to treat, and then who is authorized to treat. And this is true for such things as inhalers, EpiPens, insulin. Document immunizations for incoming students, paying close attention to kindergartners, homeschoolers entering at any grade level, and then also sixth graders. Note any exemptions and document those. Stay current. Should there be an infectious disease in the school, you may need to notify specifically those parents of students who have immunization exemptions. Have a general procedure for medical emergencies, who and how to notify, and how to call 911. Information to have handy while calling 911. Send someone out to meet the first responders, divert foot traffic away from the victim, and then clear the classroom for privacy. Contact the parents and meanwhile administer basic first aid until responders get there, and then manage the situation until either the student is transported or things are resolved. Provide returning staff and require incoming staff to be first aid certified through either the American Red Cross or the American Heart Association or another certifying body. Certifications are usually good for 2 years, and we place small laminated red hearts on the teachers' signs outside their classrooms so that anyone on a hallway and unfamiliar with the staff would know who is first aid certified and who to go to for help in an emergency. Decide whether or not you and your school, if you're going to have AEDs, automated external defibrillators. If so, where you're going to place them on campus. How you're going to maintain them, how you're going to train staff, coaches, and also replacing some of the working parts once they've been used. We're a school of about 800 students on 21 acres. We have 39 sports teams. So we have three AEDs, one in the field house for easy access from outside, and then one in the main building off the lobby in close proximity to the gymnasium, and then we have one upstairs in the auditorium. So next I want to talk a little bit about health as it relates to asbestos. The EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency, has oversight over AHERA, which is the Asbestos Hazard Emergency Response Act. And these regulations may come through the state's occupational and environmental branch. Note that asbestos materials are still readily available for purchase at home improvement stores and can be used in construction. So if you are building, please specify and watch those guidelines for materials and make sure that they're asbestos-free. And then get a certified letter from your architect who's overseeing the project to make sure that that indeed happened. So you need to be careful when you're renting, leasing, buying, or remodeling. You need to be especially careful if asbestos has been identified, or even if it hasn't, you may need to take some steps to ascertain whether or not there's asbestos in the building. And asbestos removal can be costly. The fines per day for being out of compliance with EPA are hefty. So know that if you're looking at an older building, again, it doesn't matter if you're buying, renting, or leasing, the requirements are the same. So you have a responsibility as a school to monitor, perhaps even sample, and you may even need to have a management plan, and all of that comes with a cost. Let's see, let's talk about health inspections. So that's a large part of what we do to get ready for the new school year. And this covers everything from cleanliness to playground equipment upkeep, and inspectors each have their own areas of expertise and places where they are really, really careful about upholding standards. Be sure you know how they're applying the standards, what storage needs to look like, the use of hand sanitizers in the building, those kinds of things. They usually require hand washing signs to be up. If there are pets in the building, some pets require hand washing after you've handled them, others don't. Some require immunization, some don't. So there's just a lot of specific requirements regarding these kinds of things around a school. Let's see, if you have showers or locker rooms, it's really important to keep those clean and everything working and functioning well. So the sinks are working well, the toilets are working. All of those kinds of things. If you have showers and looking for pink algae, making sure the water fountains are clean, all of those things come together and are under the health inspection regulations. If you have sports, keeping the coolers and the water bottles clean, cleaning out ice machines and having regular maintenance for those. So a good and regular cleaning schedule for the interior and exterior really helps you to be ready for any type of a drop-in inspection. Store items up off the floor, especially items for personal use and food. And assign tasks to your janitors and also to the students and to the staff, and have everyone participate in the routine cleaning. So we do much of that over the summer. Food safety. So whether you have bag lunches, a delivery program, catering, or a full-fledged cafeteria, the health inspector is also overseeing all of those items regarding food safety, keeping refrigerators at the proper temperatures, making sure freezers are cold, keeping cold foods cold, hot foods hot, This is true for concession stands as well. So there's a lot of areas that the health inspector works on. So playground equipment, basketball goals, all of those kinds of things need to be in good repair as well. Next would be security. You need to have controlled entry into the school, direct visitors to one entrance, allowing entrance only through that location. Whether you have keyed or keyless entry, check to see what the norm is in your area. Cameras are a good idea. When there's trouble, you can sometimes identify the perpetrators, but not always. And I must add, there are no evil-proof answers. At our school, we evaluate yearly, and we had been looking at a FOB system for probably the last 3 years. We've had a keyed entry system for 17 years, and we are just now implementing the first phase of the FOB system for just our exterior doors. And there are all kinds of other methods, badge readers, you can punch in codes. As much as the technology changes, there's always new things that you can look at. But have a good plan with the board and the administration. So don't overreact, don't underreact. If everybody in your area has a FOB system, then perhaps it'd be a good idea to move to that. I do want to mention about cameras, evaluate where they're placed, add additional cameras where you need to, and then also sometimes they need to be reoriented. Their angles can get off. I want to mention now the CIRC process. Does anybody know the CIRC, the C-I-R-K? This stands for Critical Incident Response Kit, and it is a physical kit, and it's housed inside the school, usually near the main entrance in the lobby area. Ours happens to be by our AED. And this kit contains building schematics, emergency phone numbers for key personnel, a master key for the building and also for interior and exterior doors, paper, pencils, security codes, and how to monitor the security cameras. So there's a user guide in there. And then a staff listing with phone numbers and then up-to-date student rosters. So this is for first responders, and then it's also a very handy tool for administrators during an emergency. Next would be inclement weather. So you need procedures for handling weather-related events. Some of these are more prevalent throughout the years. And this can range from watches, warnings, to actual events. In our area here in the south, tornadoes are quite a threat. So we hold drills 4 times a year in the first and fourth quarters. Other common weather-related events might include things like hurricanes, storm systems that might be heavy rain producers, earthquakes, high winds, floods, mudslides, all kinds of things, ice and snow events, air quality warnings, and those kinds of things. So in your area, you may have specific things. Wildfires or tsunamis might be more prevalent. So you have to have standards and procedures for handling all of those weather events, whether it be carpool, sports, PE classes, recess, or those types of things. Weather alert radios are always a good tool to have at the school, and they will let you know of watches and warnings. And local weather stations typically have warning systems where they can email directly to schools and to individual viewers of any type of warnings in the area. So keep the weather up on your computer or on your phone pretty much all the time. And then have a way of notifying parents of these types of warnings. So whether it be a text system for messaging, whether it be reader boards, email notification, phone trees, whatever the method is, have a method in place for notifying parents. And then be sure to train staff and coaches how to handle these situations for the safety of the students, because sometimes people will have varying degrees of standards. So be sure that you have that for the school. And understand the differences between warnings and watches. So watches would be that the conditions are favorable. Warnings would be that an event has actually occurred or been spotted and reported. The next item would be fire. So fire drills are the best drill you will ever do. They do save lives. They've become so commonplace, I think we forget that there's a reason these catastrophes have decreased, and it's due to faithful practice, even with schools that have sprinkler systems. So there are many fire hazards in a school, not the least of which would be lots of paper and books. So have a schedule for regularly, yearly equipment inspections, and have all of that done. The summertime is a good time to do that. And this will include your main fire panels, the sprinkler systems if you have them, all types and parts of your working system, your emergency backup phone lines, fire extinguishers, elevators, all of those are part and components of the fire system. And you need to have a good evacuation procedure for each and every room in the school. And write out those detailed instructions and practice the fire drills monthly, both announced and unannounced. Vary the time of day. Have primary and secondary exits marked on what we would call an egress diagram, and that's usually in full view as you're exiting the room. We have found that the best place for detailed instructions and guidelines are in the staff manual. And working closely with our local fire department and our fire educator, we have developed some fire prevention training, and we have some staff information that staff goes through each year, and then there's some self-quizzes in there that we have them do. And it includes everything from how to use a fire extinguisher to how to recognize different types of smoke and what type of fire might be causing that, and where all of the fireboxes are located in the building. So that is important training, and training that's covered each year by the administrators and then also covered at the new teacher orientation annually. If your school has a science laboratory, then there are requirements for chemicals and how they're handled and how they're stored and the usages and also disposals. So you need to work closely with your fire marshal on those items. Okay, our basic safety procedures are in the parent-student handbook, and that includes fire drills, inclement weather info, and lock-in and lock-down. But these are very general guidelines. Specifics for teachers are found in the staff manual, which is a confidential document. And then the specifics for administration are found in a higher-level book, which would be an administrative handbook. So this is a very dynamic and working document. So now let's talk a little bit about lock-in and lock-down. Lock-in and lock-down should both be announced and unannounced drills for staff and students. Start with announced and then move over time to unannounced. There should be guidelines for interior and exterior procedures. And what I mean by that is that a person on your campus, whether they're inside or outside, should know exactly what to do anytime a lock-in or a lockdown is issued. And don't get too far into those specifics without consulting your local police department and your resource officer. So each school should have a district officer assigned to the school and also a resource officer. And these are great resources for us to use. It's very good to talk with the people who respond to emergencies and who work with numerous schools and have this additional specialized training. So seek wise counsel and then formalize your plans. We do lock-in and lock-down drills 2 to 4 times a year, depending on the year. So have a plan to notify your staff and your parents if there's a lock-in or lockdown. Again, whatever method or combination of methods you use, just be sure that you know those. Check response times for police, fire, and ambulance. We are about a half a mile from fire response, which does include first responders and medical. So let's talk about the differences between lock-in and lockdown. A lock-in is warranted for any threat in the local school community, such as bank robberies, high-speed chases, armed suspects believed to be in the area, any type of police emergency close to your school. So at that point, all exterior doors are locked. Interior doors may be locked. The classrooms are readied. Windows are closed and locked. Blinds are completely down and in the closed position. But class continues on a semi-regular schedule. You typically move away from the windows, but other than that, the students stay inside the building and they don't go outside for any reason. Be sure you can get in to lock in quickly, and then some lock-ins will move directly to lockdown. Lockdown means that there's imminent danger in the building or just outside the door. Be sure that you can get into lockdown mode quickly. Things that are required are all of the lock-in procedures and then some. So at that point, you need to make sure that the lights are out in the classroom, the classroom doors are locked, students are out of the line of sight from the door, from the classroom door, and there's silence. And keys must be handy and close by, so teachers need to be trained to keep those with them. So you may receive information or notification on a lock-in or lockdown through reverse 911, or an administrator can issue one at any time. So practice, beat your time, evaluate, look to see where you have room for improvement, and then practice again. So it's imperative that teachers and staff understand that no matter where they are in the classroom, en route from one classroom to the next, hallways, or any portion of the building or outside, that they have a clear understanding of what they do if the lock-in or lockdown is issued. And walk the campus and look at your procedures and see where you may need to improve. Let's see, we use the common color system. So the yellow is for lock-in, and the red is for lockdown, and the green is for all clear. So that should be pretty standard. And then there's another color system for lockdown. How many of you use the blue, green, and red cards? Okay. So what this is a method of communicating with administrators and first responders in the case of a lockdown. So first of all, we have these index-sized cards, and these are hole-punched, and they are right behind the door in the classroom. So when a lockdown is issued, a teacher posts either a red or a green. The green would mean everything is okay in this classroom. The red means that there's been trouble of some sort. And if you have any type of a health need in the classroom, this is posted. So two of these small signs go on the small window pane of the classroom door. And at a glance, anyone coming through the building can tell everything's okay or they need assistance right away. So there's a similar card system, only larger. Ours are 8.5 by 11 that are over by the window, and they get placed in the window after the windows are closed and locked and before the blinds are completely lowered and readied. And this system mirrors what is in the classroom door pane. So again, it's either a green or a red. So any type of problem, a bullet has come through the window, somebody's been hurt, any kind of trouble at all, the red one goes up. If everything's fine, the green goes up. And you'll notice that we have samples of the classroom number is on this. So at the window, it is pointing outside. Any first responder or police coming to the campus can glance up and know right away where there's trouble and where help is needed. So it's a really good communication tool. The blue card would signify whether or not there was a help need. So let's say you had a diabetic in the classroom, or maybe somebody's in a wheelchair and additional assistance is going to be needed for a health-related issue. Again, this is a very effective communication tool. Let's say a teacher forgets and doesn't put them up. Well, an administrator would need to go and check on that. An administrator is always going to know which classrooms would or would not be occupied, and any kind of failure to put the signage up would simply mean maybe they forgot or maybe there's a problem. Let's see. I want to share, as we're just wrapping this part up, and we're going to talk a little bit more about lockdown in a minute, I just wanted to mention that a wise mentor of mine several years ago gave me some good advice, and it's been most helpful, and I wanted to share it with you. But he said, major in the majors, any type of school safety-related portion that could have the school shut down, fix that, spend time on that first, and then build out from there. And that was really good counsel. So if you have a good health program developed, if you understand the asbestos and the sanitation and fire inspections, if you've worked on building security, if you understand the inclement weather issues for your area, and you understand basically what to do in a lock-in and lockdown, you have a basic safety program. And then once you have the basics down, it's time to move up a level, and you're going to begin to build a more comprehensive plan. And if you write simple, basic procedures, it's easier to continue to build on those. So let me explain a little bit about what I mean. So once you have a fire evacuation plan, the fire procedure works for most evacuations. So what might arise to require you to evacuate? Maybe a gas leak, some sort of malfunction in the building, chemical spill, or a bomb threat. Those types of things might require evacuation. So if you have a good, solid evacuation plan in place, it works for things other than just the fire. Secondly, most serious scenarios can be handled through either lock-in or lockdown. So what I mean by that is if there are weather-related events, it's typically handled through a lock-in. Your area of refuge may change because you're probably going to move students out of the classroom and into hallways, but you're still going to keep the students and the staff safe, and they'll be inside. Lockdown also works for most dangerous situations. You only need the one procedure. So the scenarios may vary, but you have your school in a ready position in lockdown for numerous situations. So typically in a lockdown, there are three main responses. They are run, hide, or confront. So if there's imminent danger, your procedures need to describe how to run or flee and where to run or flee and how to refuge in place. Your procedures need to identify how students or staff can hide, where they can hide, and what their options are. And then lastly, confront. And people vary a lot on this particular aspect of lockdown. Some people are very comfortable with confrontation with armed intruders, and others are not. So I think as a school and as an administrative staff, you have to walk through all of these and determine where you're going to land. I've added a distract scenario there as a fourth response, and some people just lump that in with the confront. But I feel like that there are a fair number of diversionary tactics that you can use and you can practice that are very, very useful. And those types of things might include pepper spray, lasers, tasers, those types of things, and the emergency kits for the administrators are very useful tools. And they can provide good diversions. And there are many other things you can do. You can use noise, fire extinguishers, those types of things that are readily available. And again, just practice those types of things. What would you do in this situation or that situation, and role play? I think that we need to streamline those procedures as much as possible so that at the heat of the moment, it's more second nature and we're quicker to take what we know and apply it to another scenario. I want to shift gears just a moment and talk about a tool that I've been using, and I'm going to call it just an emergency crisis guide. So I have a couple of these down front, and you're welcome to come and look at them when we're done. And it's a quick reference tool. I've used one for a number of years, and it wasn't organized very well. It was a tool, but not a very useful one. So I've spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out how can I do this better. Because I'm sure you know as well as I do, many times during an emergency or a crisis, it's not always the administrator who is first responding and managing and handling that. Sometimes it's a support staff member or a receptionist. And I felt like I wanted to get this information into their hands in a useful way where they would feel prepared and equipped to manage a situation. So useful in the sense that we don't want it to get filed away. We want it out and on people's desks so that they can use it. And I decided on a flip chart. So I have been using a flip chart for probably the last 10 years. And you probably have one. But if not, I want to encourage you to work on this. It is really handy for new employees or a substitute. Let's say somebody's out and another person has just slid in to cover for them. You just never know when you might need this. So I want to be clear, it's not the playbook, but it is a detailed guide, and you just have to decide what it is that you're going to place in your emergency guide. So this is what ours looks like. It's very bright and colorful, and I have it tabbed, so it's real quick to flip open. So it's flat on the desk, and then you can flip it, and the information is right here. And the tabs are at the top and the bottom, so you understand where you are in case you need to flip through the guide. And I have most of these items in semi-ABC order. So I'm just going to list for you what's in our guide. And you, of course, right away will think, oh, I don't need that, might want to add this. So, and I have these written down for you on the yellow handout down here at the front. So there's an overview regarding the tool and how to use it. And then there's a bomb threat and then response sheets. So you can write directly in the guide if you were to receive a phoned-in threat. The next one is child abuse, neglect suspected, death of a student or staff member, evacuation, fire, general emergency procedure, contacting law enforcement, gas leaks and hazardous materials, a hostage situation, an intruder, lock-in and lockdown, media, medical emergencies, out-of-control student, questions, restraining orders, school vehicle accidents, severe weather, social services, strangers on campus, and we also include our procedures for our sex offender list are there, suicide attempts, taking cover, and then at the very back of the guide are all of the vital contacts, phone numbers, security codes, and those types of things that would be needed in an emergency. So they're almost exclusively in ABC order so that you can find things real quickly. And I found that that works well. Let's see, I have a couple of desk copies down here and then this one as well if you'd like to look at those later. Let's see. My main goal, again, was not necessarily to train administrators, although a new administrator would find it helpful, but it was mostly for support staff. And I will say that once I took the time to compile the information and distribute it to support staff, they found it very helpful and useful, and they also felt like they had been brought from an uncomfortable place to their comfort zone. And so it was a really good time well spent for us. Okay, I have a couple of slides now that will go through just a sample or two. So I've got a bomb threat, social service visit, and then a hazardous leak or spill. So I'm going to show you what this looks like so that you can see that it's not just a sentence or two or a definition, it's substantive. And although it may not be everything you would need to respond to an incident, it is very specific and guided and will get you through till help can arrive. So again, it is substantive. It's not just defining a lock-in. So let's see. Let's look at the bomb threat. So as you can see, there's a lot of information there, and that's one of the things I just want to point out to you. About a third of the way down, it says, do not use two-way radios. So hopefully that would be obvious. And then about another third of the way down, it talks about suspicious packages. So I put that here with the bomb threat because I felt like they were very, very similar. On the next slide, it describes the information that you're gathering if it's been phoned in and the caller has them still on the line, the types of questions and information that you're going to gather that would be very useful once police or responders were there. And jotting down time and just keeping these records are really, really important during a threat. On our actual guide, that is a chart, and you can write on the sheet, so it keeps everything contained in one area. Let's see. The next one is social services. So just remember, with social services, we are the child's advocate, first and foremost. So if you have somebody come and stop in at the school, be sure to check their ID, take their business card, and invite them to sign in as a visitor and be very kind to them, and then take the time that it needs to verify that they are who they are and that they have been sent to see a specific child. So you want to be really careful and protect the child in that way. Many times parents will already know that they're coming to visit. Sometimes they'll notify you, sometimes they won't, but phone that parent and let them know that social services is there. And then find a private place for the meeting. Go and get the child and explain to a younger child the process and what is happening and that someone is there to ask questions and they're there to help. And then stay in with the child during the meeting if you can. If not, stand right outside the door and make sure that that child is not afraid and that they're comfortable in that situation and stay there and monitor it until it's until that session is ended. So we found that this procedure has worked well. The next example I just wanted to show you has even more information on it. And so this is gas leaks and hazardous spills. And this describes everything from how to detect or recognize an odor to what to do if you're inside a building or outside a building and how to manage things. So, for example, if you're inside the building and there are electrical switches, you leave everything in its current state. So you're trying to prevent arcs and sparks. And then it goes on to show what to do outside. If you're found to be outside, how to move downwind and those kinds of things. And if you have automobiles running, you turn those off. So having these procedures in place, you may need to evacuate the building and you would follow your evacuation procedure. And when you would get to your area of refuge, you would perhaps then have to move the student body and the staff based on the circumstances, but it's a good procedure. And I would also add that if your school is near a rail system, a train system, or on truck routes, this is a procedure that you might need. So those were just three examples of the types of entries that you would find in our emergency crisis guide. And again, many different things that you might prefer to add or take away, but this is what we decided on. Next, I want to just touch on a comprehensive school safety plan. So you have the basics that we've described earlier, and then you have this emergency guide plan that still covers another 20 or so items. And so you are already beginning to build a pretty good plan for school safety. The next level is the administrator's book on school safety, and that's the playbook. And people have asked me, did you bring it? No, because all of our secrets and all of our plans are in that book. And it's a very important document, and it's one that needs to be revised and revisited often. But it's something that's really important for a school to have. So you might ask, how did we compile this level of procedure and detail? And it happened over time, of course. So for years, I would have a file, and I would keep things as I would realize that over time practice had occurred and this is what we were doing and it was a good practice, and I would write that down and put it in there. Or as I would find different procedures at a school or at a university and I liked it and I felt like it was a good, strong procedure, I would put that in. So over time, it just accumulated. And then, of course, you write things as things happen too. And so I put them in a file, A to Z, and that's kind of where I came up with this school safety from A to Z. So what I did was I went back to our emergency crisis guide, and I would copy in those procedures so that we would have consistency. And then for administrators, many times you might need to provide history, why a specific thing is really important, and then you might need the rationale, and you might need to explain some of the procedures, because somebody new coming in might say, well, that doesn't make sense, but you need to give detail so that everybody is equipped to handle whatever emergency might be. So over time, I would insert those. Again, I would expand them, write explanations, and then it slowly built into an administrative manual for school safety. So I want to give you just a couple of examples of what might be in that document. So the first one that you might see in an A entry would be animal control, and that wouldn't be students, but that would be other such things as, it could be geese problems, it could be alligators, whatever you have in your area that might present a problem. But it starts with any kind of animal, even coming through carpool, and then show and tell, and what are your requirements for that? class pets, and then animals that might be allowed to come on campus for sporting events, friendly pets and animals. And then you work all the way up through animals that might be diseased or vicious that might be on campus, and then when to call animal control. So all of those procedures would be together. Hopefully that makes sense. Another procedure that would be in the administrative manual would be a citywide evacuation. So you would need to know the procedures for your town and know the evacuation routes and how that traffic might affect your school. And then know, if you have some type of an emergency, who's the last man or woman out, and where are all of the supplies to refuge in place? Where is the water kept? Where's the food? Those types of things. So it could be anything from a storm delay to an outright geographical emergency. So all of that's good to have a procedure outlined and ready to go. Another one that I'll give an example for would be E for earthquake. We had never had an earthquake in the Raleigh-Durham area, as far as I know. And then 2 years ago, we actually felt some tremors from a quake in the Richmond, Virginia area. And that was about 2.5 hours away. There was some damage to some buildings in a town adjacent to us, but none where we were. So we needed an earthquake procedure. Fortunately, we have a field trip to Central America, which is a very an area that's very prone to earthquakes. So we did have a procedure there. And so we took that and adapted it. And we used some key words that the students already knew. So the students during fire prevention week, the younger ones, learned the stop, drop, and roll. So we adapted stop, drop, and hold for the earthquake. And so it was an easy, catchy way for them to remember. So I just want to encourage you to write standard operating procedures. Keep them really simple and basic, and the more similar they are, the easier it will be for people to implement your procedures. And if you're like me and you're very, very busy as an administrator, just put it on your calendar and set a goal to write one a week or one a month, and just do it. And then have procedures in place for training your staff and walking it through and talking it through, and then making sure that you incorporate your local authorities. And it's a great opportunity with health inspectors and fire inspectors to be a real light in the community and to be a blessing to those inspectors, and from the top down to model obedience and to have a great rapport with them. Let's see. The one other thing I wanted to mention with staff training is just set aside some time and make safety part of that. And in keeping with continuous improvement, I just wanted to mention a couple of things. You need to reevaluate these procedures anytime there's a management change, anytime there's a building expansion or renovation. And then I would also go on to add that anytime an event occurs, such as Sandy Hook, we all learn from those types of things, and then we need to incorporate changes so that we are better prepared, and we want to learn from those things. And then also reevaluate as technology changes dictate. Not as technology changes, because that's all the time, but as it dictates and as budget can absorb that, do that as well. So the last slide is not in your outline, but I felt like that I wanted to mention at least some of the areas where you might feel and where we might feel as a school that we're vulnerable. And one of those might be disgruntled employees or dismissed employees, and have a procedure in place for employees to share a concern regarding a coworker. And I think we've seen a little bit more of this arise in the community and in the workplace, and I think that schools should at least look at that. Disgruntled students is another area. Perhaps students who have been dismissed or parents and families. They should be on our radar. It's not just graffiti anymore. Their anger can really play out in very dangerous ways. So I think that we should at least be cognizant of that. Another area might be full school assemblies. And whether they're inside or outside, perhaps we need to use some caution in how we're advertising those. And again, we don't want to be fearful, but there may be a time and a place for us to just look at who really needs this information. Some schools may feel like that carpool is an area where they're vulnerable. How many entrances and exits are there to your property, and how quickly can you shut them down and get containment? That's a really important aspect. Are you on a really busy street in the middle of the city, or are you out in a real isolated area? So those are some considerations. Have really good whistle and clear the field emergency drills for students, and keep that the same K through 12, so that any time there's an emergency, the students know through their recess drills exactly what to do, and any adult supervising them knows exactly what to do. And that will come in handy, because it won't matter what the situation, the students will know exactly what to do, and they'll be prepared to respond correctly. So practice that often. Sporting events may be another area where you feel vulnerable as a school. So talk about it administratively, or seek wisdom from your board. And then another thing I thought about was, are your students outside during class changes? And are they outside often? And is there a way, perhaps, to enclose breezeways or to make your building safer for them throughout the day? So really, we've covered a tremendous amount of material this afternoon, and I know it's late. I wanted you to feel like you could understand how we were building the basics and then moving to the emergency crisis guide, and then to an administrative manual for school safety. So I hope that it's been beneficial to you. I want to end, though, with a scripture from 1 Samuel 2, and it's Hannah's prayer. And it starts like this: "My heart rejoices in the Lord, and the Lord, my horn, is lifted up high. My mouth boasts over my enemies, for I delight in your deliverance. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. Do not keep talking so proudly, or let your mouth speak such arrogance, for the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed." And down in verse 9, "For the foundations of the earth are the Lord's. On them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven, and the Lord will judge the ends of the earth." So thank you so much for coming this afternoon. Please come up and look at the guides. I would welcome your feedback. If you're using something at your school, I know I can make mine better. And I'm going to take questions down here, just because of the sensitivity and some of the confidentiality with the subject. Thank you.